On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Iran's big talking president knows how to get the world's attention. Yesterday, in a letter to President Bush, he said Western democracy is doomed and the whole planet hates America. He's said again and again that Israel should be wiped off the map. He threatens oil supplies and Americans in Iraq. And then, of course, there's the apparent Iranian push for nuclear weapons that has Washington and the UN in fits. If the whole world is watching, maybe no one is watching and listening more closely than Iranians abroad as Tehran pushes the limits. This hour, we'll hear their intimate perspective. Up next on Point, Iranian voices on mullahs, nukes, and Iran's future as Tehran pushes the patience of the world. Joining me now from New York with the latest on the Iran nuclear standoff is Barbara Slavin, senior diplomatic correspondent for USA Today. Barbara, I know you were following this late into the night. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for getting me up.
Here we are. Face the day. Give us a sense of what was in this letter. This was not exactly, let's work out the nuclear problem. There was a big worldview lecture here.
Yeah, well, it's kind of Socratic. It raises a number of questions for President Bush. It actually raises some questions for President Ahmadinejad himself about what makes a great leader. I think he's trying to evaluate his own presidency as well. He talks about the fact that those in power have a specific time in office, do not rule indefinitely. Their names will be recorded in history and will be constantly judged in the immediate and distant futures. And he asks President Bush, what kind of job have you done? What have the hundreds of billions of dollars spent every year done for Iraq, for your own people? And so it's kind of a lecture, and it's kind of a sort of rambling musing on the principles that govern the world. He expresses sympathy for September 11th, repeats a lot of things I've heard.
That is sympathy for the United States after those attacks, right?
Yeah, for the United States and for the people of the United States. He said it was a horrendous incident. The killing of innocents is deplorable and appalling. And then he sort of goes on from there and questions what the Bush administration has done in the aftermath of September 11th. So it's something that I think Iran scholars are going to be studying for a long time to get clues to this guy's personality.
But the bottom line, not exactly comforting for American president. He says democracy has failed worldwide. He laments an ever-increasing global hatred of the U.S. government.
Yes, he does.
Looks at liberal Western-style democracy, liberalism, broadly speaking, and says, today, these two concepts have failed. Those with insight can already hear the sounds of the shattering and fall of the ideology and thoughts of the liberal democratic systems. That's a pretty tough message for any American president to take on board. I mean, does that mean these countries are just at loggerheads and that's it?
Well, Ahmadinejad is a kind of unique case. He is very, very steeped in the ideology of this revolution. He's kind of a throwback to its early days. He's very religious. I think he believes the things that he's saying, and he's basically asking President Bush to change his ways and to become a better leader and giving him advice on how he should run his presidency. What is astonishing, and of course Condoleezza Rice remarked on this, is that there's only one very passing reference where he talks about the nuclear issue, and he presents it, let me see if I can get the language right, he complains that the United States is criticizing him. Yeah, he says, why is it that any technological and scientific achievement reached in the Middle East region is translated into and portrayed as a threat to the Zionist regime?
Maybe because he said Israel should be wiped off the map. Maybe.
Well, he doesn't repeat that here. He has a kind of gentler formulation, which is that he even admits that it's possible that 6 million Jews may have died, but the question he raises from that is, does that translate into the establishment of the State of Israel, which he argues has brought more suffering to more people?
So, Barbara,
he doesn't call for Israel. He wiped off the map.
Not in this letter.
Not in this letter, no.
Bridge us from this letter, the first in many, many years to pass between Tehran and the White House, and what's going on at the UN. Are we near a resolution there that would crank up the pressure on Tehran or not?
Well, we're not. Last night, the foreign ministers from all the five veto-holding members of the UN Security Council, the U.S., Britain, France, Russia, China were there, plus Germany, and Javier Solana, the representative of the European Union. They met 4 hours, 2 hours, I think, before dinner, and then another hour and a half over dinner. And my understanding is they're no closer to resolving the basic problem, which is that the Western countries are ready to pass a tough resolution that could lay the groundwork for sanctions against Iran, and the Russians and the Chinese are still not on board. There was talk, John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., thought there might be a vote on a resolution this week. We had a briefing late last night from a senior American official, as they're called, who doubted that there would be a vote this week. Looks like there may have to be another high-level meeting next week in Europe. So this is very slow-moving. The Russians and the Chinese are still very, very leery about this kind of what's known as a Chapter 7 resolution.
Because they do a lot of business with Iran. They get a lot of oil from Iran in China's case, and they don't want to put anything out there that could later, as in the case of Iraq, be used to justify, what, military action that they're not on board with?
Absolutely. I think everyone is very worried about following a pattern similar to that with Iraq and what it might lead to.
Does the United States really look ready to follow that kind of pattern? We had Seymour Hersh on a couple weeks ago with The New Yorker saying battle plans are being drawn up to attack Iran, U.S. attack on Iran. Does that seem borne out by what you see in Washington and New York, Barbara?
No, I don't think we're there yet. I think there's a lot of contingency planning that has gone on for a long time and has accelerated, but the sense I get, no, is that it's going to be a diplomatic push, that if they can't get a strong resolution through at the UN, there will be a quote-unquote coalition of the willing, but this time for sanctions, financial sanctions, trade sanctions, sanctions on the assets and travel of senior Iranian leaders, that's the route that they would go down first and for a while. And, you know, the estimates all are that the Iranians are still some years away from having enough enriched uranium to actually build a weapon. So I don't get a sense of panic about it, although obviously it is important that they keep moving. But
So not exactly deja vu all over again at the UN on this, not exactly a direct echo of the road to war with Iraq.
No, not at all. We don't have that same drumbeat. And frankly, the U.S. is not in a position, I think, to contemplate that, given the fact that there's still over 100,000 American troops in Iraq, and given the damage that the Iranians could do to those troops and to U.S. interests in other parts of the region.
That is, if they really begin to meddle there with their fellow Shiites, where they have enormous sway, not to mention physical proximity.
Yes, absolutely. So you don't get a sense that anyone is eager to see it move in that direction, although, as U.S. officials say, they will never take that option off the table.
And a lot of heat and concern about the rising nuclear capacity in Iran that Iran is not walking away from. Barbara Slavin at the UN, or in Washington today, I guess. Thanks very much for being with us, Barbara. Still in New York?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thanks for being with us. Sorry to get you up so early after a late night.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
Barbara Slavin, senior diplomatic correspondent for USA Today. We turn first today among the Iranians that we're going to talk with about this nuclear standoff to Nazrin Abdullahi. She was born and raised in Tehran, still has family there. She was in Tehran last month when President Ahmadinejad announced that Iran had successfully produced low-grade enriched uranium. She joins me from New York, where she's a business consultant in the private sector. Nazrin, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
So here we are. You feel the heat rising around your homeland. How does it look to be sitting in New York and watching all this going on? You're just back from Tehran. Does it feel like a train wreck in unfolding here? How do you see it?
It is worrisome. I personally don't worry much about the military operation. I think the possibility is low now because of the experience we had in Iraq. I think if that wouldn't have happened, that was a very high possibility.
So you mean the U.S., you don't believe, has the capacity or the willingness, with Iraq already boiling around it, to get in militarily to Iran?
Absolutely. I think Iran is much more complex case if they want to have military action. And not only is the capacity, is the support inside U.S. and support outside. I don't think we can mobilize outside support or even internally.
And what about in Iran? You were just there a couple of months ago. Do Iranians know or believe or understand, you choose the word, that their country appears to be trying to develop nuclear weapons? Do the bulk of Iranians support that move?
I don't believe Iranians support nuclear weapon. They really distinguish between nuclear capability and nuclear weapon. And a lot of Iranians oppose having nuclear weapon, and they think it's kind of madness to pursue that. But at the same time, especially among young generation, I was there when they made the announcement, there is a sense of pride having nuclear capability. And I think there is actually the negative rhetoric and pressure from the U.S. is generating much more patriotic and nationalistic feeling.
But Iran is oil rich. Why do they want nuclear capabilities so badly? Why is that so important? That, and you mean nuclear energy production capacity there. Why?
It's always, even I got my bachelor in Iran during the Shah, and even at that time, and I studied politics there, we always discussed the vulnerability of relying on oil only for our energy, because eventually we are going to run out of oil. And even at that time, we were discussing the advantages of using nuclear energy, especially for electricity and other peaceful means. So it's not a new issue. It's something that we always consider if we want to be independent and powerful long term.
We're talking this hour with Iranians in the United States about the nuclear standoff with Iran. It is growing hotter. We're going to hear a lot of voices in this hour. We've been joined so far by Nazrin Abdullahi, born and raised in Tehran, still has family there, just back from Tehran last month. She's with us from New York, from Washington right now. We're joined by Karim Sajjadpour. He's Iran analyst for the International Crisis Group, a non-governmental organization, writes on Iranian society and politics, was in Iran most recently last summer. Karim Sajjadpour, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
So here Nazrin tells us, and we read that Iranians are very supportive of developing nuclear power capacity. Of course, that's the whole issue. The IAEA of the UN and almost everybody now says that right along with that, they're developing nuclear weapons, and that Ahmadinejad has been quite successful in raising public support by loudly proclaiming their determination to do exactly that. Are we reading this right? Are Iranians... Nazrin says they don't line up behind the weapons, but how do you tell the difference?
Yeah, well, you know, I agree with Nazrin that people are opposed to the development of a nuclear weapon. And what I would argue is that there's a general ambivalence when it comes to this entire nuclear project. On one hand, Iranians are quite nationalistic. It's a very old culture, old civilization. And they look around and say, well, India, Pakistan, Israel can have this project. Why shouldn't we be allowed? Why this double standard? At the same time, I think there's a great concern throughout Iran these days. Remember, this is a country which experienced the bloodiest war of the second half of the 20th century.
With Iraq.
500,000 casualties. Not one family was really left unscathed by this war. So there's a great concern among many people about the direction in which the country is headed. You know, when people think about this nuclear project, on one hand, it is, for some, a symbol of national pride. But on the other hand, no one romanticizes about the prospect of militarization, about the prospect of conflict. So there is a concern. And quite frankly, this is a very technical project. You know, the act of enriching uranium indigenously as opposed to importing enriched uranium from abroad. So the idea that, you know, your average Iranian wakes up in the morning in Yazd or in Shiraz or in Kerman and says, you know, what's missing from my life is enriched uranium has been a bit exaggerated as well.
Maybe exaggerated, but the government still seems to be on that path, and the Iranian people not pushing them off of it. I'm reading here Time magazine quoting a Western diplomat in Tehran saying, before you had people versus the regime, that is, the mullahs, the theocrats. Now you have Iraq versus the West. Did you feel that, Nazrin? In Tehran a couple of months ago, do you feel an anti-West sentiment in the street, the kind that the president of Iran packed into his letter to President Bush yesterday?
I really don't think you see anti-West sentiment. And the type of sentiment and demonstration you see, and this is the same type of organized one by the government. But I think what Ahmadinejad has done, he's trying to use this type of external opposition to present himself as a more nationalistic leader, which I don't believe is necessarily true. And I completely agree that people are very concerned in Iran about, and they are ambivalent about the nuclear capability. But the more pressure comes from outside, the more patriotic they get. So the opposition becomes more hidden, and more emotions, nationalistic emotion appears, and more you see a lot of interviews coming from Iran. You hear more support in the public because now the attention is on something else, which is the outside is trying to prevent us for developing this type of capability. But there is a lot of concern because they are very worried still about military attack, and they're very worried about economic sanctions.
So they're aware that that an attack could at some point come. Karim Sajiput, remind us of the structure, the governmental structure in Iraq. I mean, everybody remembers, Americans certainly, back to 1979, those who were, adult, grown up enough to be aware then of how the Islamic Revolution took over. Today, Ahmadinejad is president, but he's not the top guy in Iran. Remind us of the governing structure there.
Well, that's right. The person who's steering this nuclear ship is Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader. And Ayatollah Khamenei is an unelected official. He's been in power. He's had this position for 17 years now, since the death of Ayatollah Khomeini in 1989. Mm-hmm. And he is someone who makes decisions by consensus rather than decree.
He's but not consensus among whom? Among his fellow mullahs? Among the Iranian people? How?
No, certainly not the Iranian people. I think among a small inner circle. And there's parallel centers, there's parallel institutions of power. There's former officials like Hashemi Rafsanjani who are very influential still. And Ayatollah Khamenei has an inner circle, what he calls the Guardian Council, which are 12 unelected officials as well.
And that's an Islamic inner circle. That's why this is a theocracy, because the buck stops with the religious leaders. Is that correct?
Well, again, yeah, the person ruling the country, Ayatollah Khamenei, is trained as a cleric. The members of the Guardian Council are clerics, and there's another body called the Expediency Council, which is headed by the former president, Hashemi Rafsanjani, who was also a cleric. Mm-hmm. But you have non-clerics as well, Ahmadinejad being case in point.
Now, he was elected. President Ahmadinejad was elected.
He was elected. It was certainly not a democratic election. The candidates were pre-selected. There's heavy vetting. Among the over one, I think there was 1,008 candidates who tried to put their name in the hat to run in this presidential election, and only 8 were given permission to run. So Iran is by no means democratic, and these elections were by no means democratic. But then once these pre-selected candidates are allowed to run, mm-hmm. It can be an interesting democratic election. I covered the election in Tehran last June.
Nazreen Abdullahi, there is a kind of wish, at least in Washington, that this regime would change, that the Iranian dissatisfaction with mullah rule would grow to the point where this would all go away and a kind of new, perhaps more secular government would come in. Do you see a chance of that, or is that years away, very distant?
I think by this new election with Ahmadinejad coming back, things are pushed back. And I think the same wish exists in Iran, but now there is a more pessimistic view. And really the big question is that how the change can happen. The only possibility, there are some talk, I don't know, I didn't have enough chance to explore it more, the discussion of there are some friction between Ahmadinejad and some of the religious factions, and is more guardian military group or guardian the revolutionary guards that are supporting Ahmadinejad. So if those type of friction happen, there is the possibility of weakening. Otherwise, if that is not true and there is this united front, I think people are more pessimistic now than before the election.
Nazreen, I'm going to ask all of our guests today, let me ask you, are we headed toward war here? How can this be solved, this standoff?
I personally don't think we are going to go to war. That's not going to happen. But I think we really should, I don't know if it happens, but we need to open up the discussion. That's the only possibility. We dealt with Pakistan, we dealt with India. I know the situation is very different.
You mean the U.S. has to accept, the world has to accept an Iranian bomb? Is that what you're suggesting?
I think we eventually have to accept that the Iran may be another India and Pakistan, but how we can make sure they are responsible, okay. And how we can monitor. We saw other countries who have been able to become responsible, but the issue, I know, is very hard to believe that with the current situation and current president and what we hear from Iran.
So there's no war if the world accepts Iran into the nuclear weapons club. Nazreen Abdullahi, born and raised in Tehran, just back from there a couple of months ago. Thank you so much for being with us.
That was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let me take a call from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Saeed is on the line. Hi, Saeed. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think the Ahmadinejad here is trying to co-opt Iranian nationalism. Iranian nationalism is the single most significant force that can stand up to Islamic radicalism and this theocracy. And Iranians understand the domestic consequences of a nuclear weapon are extremely poor for the Iranian people. The Iranian people now are engaged in an epic battle for freedom and self-governance.
Are they really? What's the evidence of that, Saeed? I mean, I don't see people marching in the streets these days.
The evidence of that are plentiful if you look around. For example, the name of Iranian dissidents, reporters, opinion makers, poets who are in prison is growing by the thousands. Just the other day, Mr. Ramin Jahanbegloo, a university professor, was arrested in the airport for attempting to attend an international conference in Germany.
This is a friend of our guest, Karim Sajidpour, so we know about that. So that's one, but do you see an uprising here? Are you suggesting that the U.S. should support regime change or wait for Iranians, Saeed?
I think that the supporting the Iranian people, the one continuing theme in Iranian history is its resilience against foreign invasion. From Genghis Khan to the Arabs to the Turks to the occupation and the Allied occupation of Iran, Iranians will always resist foreign invaders.
But if the U.S. and the U.N. stay out, that leaves the path open, apparently, at this point anyway, for nuclear weapons development.
There is a race between the democratic aspirations of Iranian people finding reality on the one hand, and the Ayatollahs chasing nuclear weapons on the other hand. This is why I believe that the Ayatollahs cannot be negotiated away from their search of nuclear weapons, because they need them for their survival. Iranians understand that once nuclear weapons are in the hands of these Ayatollahs, no international body will ever come to the aid of the Iranian people. The type of international pressure that is needed to allow the Iranian dissidents to have any opportunity for free expression will be gone.
Saeed, you paint a first-class conundrum for us there, a history of resisting foreign involvement and yet a kind of call for some kind of support against the mullahs. Thanks for your call. I want to bring another voice into our conversation. From New York also, Leela Azam Zanganeh joins us. She's editor of the anthology My Sister, Guard Your Veil, My Brother, Guard Your Eyes, Uncensored Iranian Voices. She's Iranian herself, hasn't been back in a long time, but pays close attention to voices from Iran. Leela Azam Zanganeh, thank you very much for being with us. You have been listening to a lot of voices. What are you hearing? What are people writing and saying about this mounting apparent crisis?
Well, I think that many of the voices, both inside and outside, have been in dismay, really, that the voice of Mr. Ahmadinejad has been burying the voices of all other Iranians. And I agree with many of the people you have on the program that it is a conundrum that, on the one hand, if the U.S. antagonizes Iran, then it will play into the hands of the Iranian government because of this historical trend of resisting to foreign powers. But in truth, the people of Iran, and the voices in my book express that in many different ways, the people of Iran do not want a military standoff. Because of the war, the revolution that took a lot of lives, there is no desire for violence and blood right now.
How do you avoid that if Iranians are kind of rallying around nuclear development nationalistically but can't derail the nuclear weapons project but don't want foreign military involvement? That seems like an impossible puzzle.
Well, you know, for now, I still think we have time for dialogue, for talking. I think that Iran has to be opened up. I firmly believe, for instance, in lifting sanctions. And for now, we are still far away. I mean, I know that uranium, Mr. Ahmadinejad declared that uranium was enriched in Iran about a month ago,
mm-hmm.
but we're still far away from having a weapon, probably, I mean, according to some experts and reports, 5 to 10 years away.
Maybe.
So Maybe. So there is still time to try and open up. That I know that, for instance, the UNA-USA, the United Nations Agency for the United States of America, has opened a dialogue in Stockholm with top-level Iranian officials. There's also been a $1 million fund by the American government to support democracy in Iran. And all of that, I mean, we still...
Small potatoes. You say lift sanctions. The UN is talking about imposing sanctions, not lifting them.
I know. I know, and that's why I think, unfortunately, you know, we are. I don't personally believe that there's going to be a war, simply because logistically it seems rather difficult with the financial and the military outpour already at play in Iraq, and also after the war in Iraq, unfortunately, the Iranian government and the Iranian officials have never slept more soundly. They know that outright invasion seems rather out of the questions for logistical and strategic reasons.
The U.S. took care of their foe in Iran, in Saddam, and their foe in Afghanistan, in the Taliban. I want to bring our listeners in once more. Muqtada is calling from Washington, D.C. Muqtada, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I wanted to make a couple of comments. There are two different issues here. One is the continuity of the regime itself, and some of the statements that Ahmadinejad has been making, atrocious statements about Israel and about the West.
You mean continuity? Do you mean will the regime last? Will it be changed?
Yes,
what?
Because one of the threats to the mullah's regime is the pro-American sentiment of the young Iranians. And if Ahmadinejad can provoke the U.S. or the West to take hostile action against Iran, that will be the fastest and the easiest way to essentially eliminate the pro-Western, pro-democracy sentiment among a vast majority of the Iranians. Having said that, the second issue of nuclear weapons, I think any country which is constantly threatened by the United States, I can't see a single day go by when somebody in the U.S. does not call for either regime change on Iran, bomb this site or drop nuclear weapons on that particular site. And also given the fact that there is an Israel there with nuclear weapons in the region, I think it would be irresponsible for any Iranian government not to pursue a viable deterrence against the U.S. and against Israel. So regardless of who comes to power, unless the U.S. is able to pull a 1953 and essentially install another Shah, an undemocratic ruler who will do the American bidding, I think any Iranian government will continue to seek a significant deterrence, and it could be nuclear weapons.
So put in a puppet, and of course that doesn't work long term, or else live with this aspiration for nuclear weapons. Muqtada, thank you for your call. Right now, from New Haven, Connecticut, we're joined by Mohsen Sasagara. He's a visiting scholar at the Yale School for International and Area Studies, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Their board of advisors has included Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle. He's a founder of the Revolutionary Guard, going way back, then became a critic of theocratic rule, attempted to run for president in 2001. He's been called Iran's Chalabi, compared to the Iraqi who helped lead the U.S. into intervention there. Mohsen Sasagara, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Are you still politically involved in Iran?
Yes, and my job is to be a politician, but not like Mr. Chalabi, of course.
What's the difference between you and Mr. Chalabi and your ambitions for American action here?
Because most of the time I have said to Americans that we don't like any intervention from Americans in Iran. The people of Iran can choose anybody which they want. The only thing that we ask, not only the Americans, but all the international community, is to put pressure on the present regime of Iran for democracy and human rights in Iran. If we could have a democratic regime over there, then the people will choose anybody who they want.
You were arrested in 2003. You spent two long stays in jail. There's a warrant out for your arrest. Even now, do you really think that Iran can democratically turn out this theocratic regime of mullahs? Can that happen?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what me and many of my friends have suggested is a referendum on the Constitution. We think that if we can mobilize the people and put pressure on this regime, then we can have a referendum on the present Constitution.
That's nice, but they put you in jail. I mean, how do you bring pressure on them? Where would the pressure come from? What would work?
The pressure would come, first of all, from the people by nonviolent and democratic actions. And second, by the international community. If, you know, they want to go for the sanction, and if they act like the Helsinki Declaration for the communist regime, if they say that any sanction is related to an item of human rights or democracy, then I think that it will create enough pressure from the international community on the present regime.
Let me ask you something. You're a politician. You'd like to go back and have a political life in Iran. Mm-hmm. Iranians are said to be in favor of nuclear development, at least for energy today. Do you think you could go home to Iran and turn back Iran's nuclear program and get elected? Or is it so popular that you can't do that?
I don't think so. I think that right now the people of Iran are in dark. They don't know that what this propaganda of regime means. I think that if you explain for the people of Iran that nobody prevents the knowledge of nuclear, nuclear knowledge in Iran, but the only thing is disarmament of the whole region, not only Iran, mm-hmm. but Pakistan and Israel as well.
Wait, so you'd go for nuclear weapons unless Pakistan and Israel gave up theirs?
I think that we can ask all the... This is a good policy in that region. If instead of going for development of nuclear weapons, we ask for disarmament of whole region.
And if you can't get that, would you also support development of an Iranian nuclear bomb?
No, I don't. I don't want that, because then we will have a very bad competition in that region. All other countries like Saudi Arabia and Turkey and other countries will ask for that.
Yep.
No. Even in that case, I prefer, because the main power of every country comes out of the economy and the people of that country, not
the
weapons.
But when the chips are down, sometimes a nuclear weapon brings a little power, too. Reza's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Reza. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I wanted to say that I agree with Mr. Sagar to some extent. However, I do believe that the cries for, all the comments being made by the Iranian president at this time, namely the wiping out of Israel and, all this havoc regarding the nuclear issue, I think the Iranian president is trying to, it would not mind being attacked by Israel. I don't think that the Iranian president would mind having another war, because that would only solidify the faltering ideals of the original Islamic Revolution. And I think that the only way that the Islamic Revolution could be re-solidified, reintegrated, the only way that he could reintegrate the masses under one Islamic flag would be by wartime, as Khomeini did back in the 1980s with the war with Iraq.
Reza, let me ask you, it says here on my screen that you're Iranian. You sound like a Virginia kid. What's your family history?
I came here when I was 13 years old. I grew up in New Jersey, and I spent about the first 13 years of my life in Iran. I came here back in 1988, right after the war.
And what do you think the United States should do now here?
I think the U.S. should pursue this, obviously, very carefully, and I certainly don't condone any military action on Iran, because, as one of the callers previously mentioned, Iran is a lot more complex case than Iraq was, and I think that any military action would certainly not be beneficial to the U.S. or the Iranian people or for U.S.-Iranian relations in the future. But I do think that they need to pursue it seriously, and I do think that it's not the nuclear issue. Having the bomb is not the issue, it's the regime, because back during the Shah's time, it would not have been a problem for Iran to become a nuclear power.
I don't know about that. The idea was to keep the club as small as possible. But I appreciate your analysis, Reza. It's very interesting. Karim Sajidpour, let me turn to you on that, if I may. Reza says Iran would welcome war with Israel. Would Iran, or more specifically, the theocratic regime, Ahmadinejad, would they welcome a military attack, let's say, from Israel? I mean, Israel would surely hit hard if they hit.
Sure. Well, I think there's elements within the regime, these confrontationist ideologues, people like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, like the hardline newspaper Kayhan, who do in some ways romanticize the early days of the revolution, this defiance and isolationism, and talking truth to power as they believe it. So I think they may welcome some type of a confrontation, not necessarily with Israel, but perhaps some military strikes from the United States. But I would say they're definitely in the minority. And the person steering the ship, as I said, Ayatollah Khamenei, he was president during the time of the Iran-Iraq war. He had practical decisions to make, while Ahmadinejad and his who were in the field fighting. And I think he realizes that it doesn't behoove the country to again go back into political, economic isolation. So if we look at Khamenei's track record the last 17 years, he's always been someone who's been opposed to both confrontation and accommodation, someone who's looking to retain the status quo.
Leila, what's the way through this? I'm not hearing it. I'm hearing even some of our guests who are not Ahmadinejad warm to Iranian nuclear power, maybe even Iranian nuclear weaponry. It's a big, powerful country, much bigger and stronger than Iraq economically and in terms of resources. What is the way through this?
Yes, it's well, it is a labyrinth. I personally do not in any way, shape or form do not want the Islamic Republic to have a nuclear weapon. I don't think it's a good idea for the region and for international stability. And again, the people that I've spoken to, the people who have written in this book, they are all representative of the civil society in Iran, and they do not wish military standoff. Now, the problem is, what do we do at the end of the day, since we're faced with this paradox? On the one hand, people not wanting a military standoff, on the other hand, sort of rallying nationalistically around the government. Well, you know, perhaps at the end of the day, I don't think anyone supports invasion at all, and invasion would surely be absolutely disastrous. But if it came, if it came to it, perhaps then at some point we would need another Ozerak, although it's logistically extraordinarily complicated and very, very risky.
Ozerak, this was the Israeli bombing of Iraq, the nuclear facilities, in 1981 or something.
1981. The mm-hmm. problem, of course, with Iran is that the nuclear plants are very scattered around the country. It's very difficult to know where they are.
And deep underground.
Deep underground, but I have read a last report from the nuclear agency saying that they do know where the plants are. So we have conflicting reports on that. But really, I think if we come to violent confrontation, it will antagonize the people of Iran. So our hope for all of us is that we can have dialogue, we can try and open up the country, and we have time. We have time. We have 5 to 10 years for that. And you know, it's important to try and put out all the options and to have the military options to just push Iran a little harder. But before that, we need to talk to the Iranians. And I believe, and most of us believe, that we need to lift sanctions of Iran. I know it's counterintuitive, but because the richer the middle class gets, you know, mm-hmm. it will trickle down. They can open up. The internet has boomed 3,000%. They're talking every day. A newspaper is closed in Tehran. In spite of Mr. Ahmadinejad, a new one is open.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are books being written, films. We need to create a platform for these people in Iran to be able to express themselves to the outside world and really to stop antagonizing them. And we still have time.
Lift sanctions. We have time. Karim Sajidpour, do we? 5, 10 years? We have that much time? We'll hear about a red line much earlier than that when the uranium enrichment gets cranked up and, you know, some in Washington are saying we can't live with even precursors of the actual weapon.
No, Leila is right. We do have time. You know, this is not a frivolous issue, but at the same time, it's not an imminent threat. I would put it, you know, let's put it in the language of American officials themselves when they talk about Iran. They invoke two ticking clocks. One is the regime change clock and one is the nuclear clock. Mm-hmm. And they want to make sure that the regime change clock ticks faster than the nuclear clock, meaning by the time Iran does have a nuclear weapon, there would be a different regime in power, a friendly representative government. The concern is, and I would argue, is that when you try to speed up the regime change clock, you simultaneously expedite Iran's nuclear ambitions because they say, well, if the Americans are indeed after a regime change approach, then we need to pursue a nuclear deterrent.
Pedal to the metal faster than ever. Excuse me.
And I would argue that at the end of the day, absent some type of a U.S.-Iran diplomatic accommodation, you're not going to make progress on either of these clocks, meaning I don't see change in Iran occurring. Absent some type of U.S.-Iran diplomatic accommodation. And I don't see this nuclear issue being resolved absent some type of U.S.-Iran diplomatic accommodation.
And I don't see the accommodation. Who's making Mohsen Sazegard? Do you see an American accommodation with the regime in Tehran coming about somehow?
I think that, you know, the dictators, they understand the language of force very well. When I say force, I mean that when President Bush says that America stands beside the people of Iran in their struggle for democracy and human rights, America must show this stance in practice. I mean that the best way is explaining for the people of Iran that the if the international community wants to go for sanction, they will relate it to the democracy and human rights issues in Iran. As Leila said, they have closed more than 100 newspapers, including three of mine. Mm-hmm. So they can say that, okay, we put this sanction, for instance, on importation on gasoline in Iran,
right.
For instance. But we will open it or we will negotiate on that if you open the newspapers in Iran. Or, you know, in this case, the people of Iran will feel that the international community is supporting their struggle. And I think that as soon as we can give hope back to the people of Iran, because right now people of Iran are somehow they have political depression because of defeat of reform movement in Iran. So as soon as they feel we give hope back to them, I'm sure that we will be able to mobilize the people to go ahead for democracy in Iran.
Leila, give us your heart of hearts here. Do you think that we're headed for, and we've had a lot more callers who wanted to join us, I'm sorry we just can't get to more, but can we get to this peaceful place? Can the Iranians stand up and respond to a foreign desire for democracy at the same time they exercise their own desire for democracy? Is it strong enough? It seems like the only thing that might pull us out of this is the Iranian desire for democracy itself.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. And I don't think it will be responding to a foreign desire. I think there is a growing desire, a nascent desire in Iran. And what we can do as the international community is to help and support that and to encourage it in every way we can within Iran. Because Iran is also, one must not forget that Iran has a very peculiar situation in the Middle East. It's the only Arab country of the Middle East with Israel and Turkey, if you consider it. As part of the Middle East. It's also a highly educated country. 60% of the students in Tehran are the university students are women. They can work, they can drive. They're very different from the women in Saudi Arabia, for instance. So we certainly do not have a democracy, but we almost have the building blocks of a democracy. We have an electoral process, we have educated women, mm-hmm. We have a thriving youth, and all of those things are extraordinarily precious, and perhaps in 20, 30 years, Iran will be, against all hopes and predictions today, the first democracy in the Middle East outside of Israel, meaning the first homegrown democracy. But we have to help them, yes, with money coming from, why not, money for democratic radios, for programs, for media, for more education and whatnot, for development, and again, with also some economic help. It's exactly the opposite of what we're doing today. And that is surely a way out of this impossible situation today.
Mm. Meanwhile, the clocks that Karim Sajidpour describes are both ticking, and they're ticking loudly. This has really been invaluable insight. I'm so grateful to all of you. Leila Azam Zanganeh, editor of the anthology My Sister, Guard Your Veil, My Brother, Guard Your Eyes. Thank you very much for being with us from New York.
Thank you.
Mohsen Sezegari in New Haven, founder of the Revolutionary Guard and much more recently an opposition candidate for president in Iran. Thank you, Mr. Sezegari, for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Karim Sajidpour, Iran analyst for the International Crisis Group. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks to our guests earlier and to all of our thoughtful callers in this hour. It's been great having all of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.